From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. James Cavanaugh, the director of the Office of Worship and Prayer, joins us. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you again.
Yeah. You're dressed for Mass.
I'm always ready.
Always ready.
Always ready.
Yeah. How wonderful. And you brought a red tablecloth with you.
Oh, well, we have some altar covers here that have been returned from the Mass down in Vallejo last month. So,
right.
Yeah, so red, one of the liturgical colors
yes.
that either are used for martyr days
mm-hmm.
or feasts of the Holy Spirit. So, yeah, so that's why we have red here today.
Very good. So you're bringing a prop in. Yeah.
No, but today, you know, my office is called the Office of
Worship and Prayer.
That's right. So today we want to focus on this notion of worship.
Yes.
You know, this segment we call Liturgy Matters,
right.
Lessons on the Liturgy. So right. we talk a lot about liturgy.
Yes.
But today I wanted to talk about this its synonym, worship, because we often use those two terms interchangeably, liturgy,
indeed,
worship,
yep.
worship, liturgy.
Yep.
The Eastern Church often calls the Eucharist the divine liturgy. So liturgy is a term that you hear us use a lot
right.
when we're talking about this. But and the reason I mention the word worship and why I want to talk about that today is because it comes up in this coming Sunday's readings.
Mm-hmm.
The climax of the gospel is in from Gospel of Luke chapter 17, and it's the story about the 10 lepers
mm-hmm.
that come to Jesus and beg for healing. And then he tells them to go to Jerusalem and show yourselves to the priests. And as they were going, they were made clean. And then it says that one of them, and he happened to be a Samaritan, recognized that he was clean long before he ever arrived in Jerusalem. And it says then he returned to Jesus to give him thanks. In fact, here's what it says. It says one of them, realizing he had been healed, returned, glorifying God in a loud voice, and he fell at the feet of Jesus and thanked him. So all of those elements are all gestures of worship.
Mm-hmm.
Realizing that he'd been returned, that's an important part, glorifying God, thanking him, and fell at his feet. So those are all characteristics of worship. Now, what's the difference between worship and liturgy? Well, before I came down this morning, I did a little word search on these words, liturgy and worship. Now, we've talked about the word liturgy before, and it, in its simplest terms, it simply means a public service. In ancient Greece, it was like a public work or some sort of public activity, oftentimes underwritten by a wealthy patron.
Mm-hmm.
It could be for a play or a musical performance or some sort of public service project or something like that. But it was something that the community was engaged in, that all people participated in, that a benefactor funded, and this became known as a liturgy, a public work, literally a work of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And when people, you know, my line of work, we talk about liturgy, that's often the way people think about the word liturgy
right.
as work of the people. And I often point out that while that's true, that's the etymology of the word. According to the Catechism, the work that we're primarily engaged in is not so much our work, but the work of God in Jesus Christ in the Paschal Mystery, the death and resurrection
right.
of Jesus. So we often use this term a lot about liturgy, but this word worship worship. And what's the difference? Well, I would put it this way, that liturgy, which means a work of the people or a public work, a public service, really is oriented around us, what we're doing, our activity, whereas worship really orients us to God, the other.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that is one of the sort of the etymology of the word worship.
I was just going to ask you.
Yeah. So this was very interesting. So
I can't even, some words, you know, you just go, okay, well, the root of that is something, you mm-hmm. know, but I worship doesn't ring any bells.
No, it doesn't. And so I did a little word search. And it's comes from an old English word, or two old English words. And the prefix of that worth, we use that word in a lot of different contexts,
sure.
Worth, literally means to turn our attention towards it. So what's particularly interesting about the readings for this Sunday, in the gospel reading, the one, the Samaritan leper, it says, and one of them, realizing he had been healed, returned glorifying God. So that idea that they were going one direction,
right,
heading off to Jerusalem, and then realizing he'd been healed, it says, then he turned or returned and went back to Jesus, fell at his knees and gave him thanks. So that act of turning towards the mm-hmm. object
mm-hmm.
Is kind of at the root
of worship.
Of what when we render something or account something as worthy, it's like we're giving our attention and turning
sure.
our attention
sure.
to it.
Sure.
So it's not so much on, you know, our activity and our what we're doing, but more on the worthiness or of the
yeah.
in this case God that we're attending to. Interestingly enough, the first reading from the second book of Kings, which is the story of Naaman the Syrian, who was healed of his leprosy. And this is the famous story where he encounters the prophet Elisha, and he desired to be healed. And Elisha told him to go into the Jordan and, you know, dip yourself seven times in the Jordan and you'll be healed. And he says, well, there's lots of other rivers in the area. Uh-huh. What's so special about the Jordan? And then his servants say, you know, if he had told you to do something really difficult, would you not have done it?
Right.
And this is simple, so why don't you do it?
Yeah.
So he did it,
yeah,
and he's
yeah.
healed. But here's the key, and the connection with the gospel. Obviously, the fact that he's a leper is an important fact, and the fact that he was a non-Israelite, mm-hmm. non-Jew, is important. Those are two important details. But the important detail, in my opinion, is this. It says, Naaman returned with his whole retinue to the man of God.
Hmm.
So again, very similar to the gospel, parallels the gospel, where once these individuals realize that God had acted in their lives, they return to give him thanks.
Hmm.
And so that act of turning towards the Lord and orienting ourselves towards God is the fundamental act of worship.
So worship, the W-O-R comes from worthy, and the ship is just, that's just what you, it's,
well,
it's worthy ship.
Well, I did a further study about that suffix, ship. Because
we use a lot.
In a lot of different words, you know,
penmanship,
exactly,
sportsmanship,
right,
et cetera,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's here's what the dictionary, the etymological dictionary, says about this suffix ship: a word forming element meaning quality, condition, act, power, skill, office, position, or relation. So it's when we that suffix ship, like you said, penmanship. It's the quality of, well, of course, mm-hmm. writing.
Right.
And it's also the power of writing. So when we attach it to worth, it's giving simply stated, it's just simply the act or the power of giving worth to mm-hmm. that which deserves our
yeah.
respect and yeah. adoration.
Wow.
Giving worth to something. And so this is essentially what the Mass is. And the reason I, you know, go into all this detail about it is because, you know, some people, young people, maybe particularly wonder, why do I have to go to Mass? Mm-hmm. You know, why? I don't understand. Well, at its most basic level, the reason we go to Mass is because God deserves our gratitude. And there are several words I wrote down here that are, in a sense, synonymous mm-hmm. with this idea of worship. And those words are love, adoration, and thanksgiving. And of course, you recognize thanksgiving mm-hmm. as being Eucharist. Right. That's what Eucharist
right.
is. It's,
right.
it's giving thanks. Well, giving thanks for what? Giving thanks for what God has done for us.
Exactly.
So at its most basic level, going to Mass is simply the act of rendering to God that which is due to God, namely our gratitude. Because there's nothing we can do or give to God that would satisfy any need he might have.
Yeah.
God has no need of anything from us. But the only thing that we can give him are these things: our love, our adoration, our worship, and our gratitude. And that's essentially what Mass and worship is all about, is giving to God our praise, our worship, our gratitude. The Catechism talks about this in the context of justice. And you may notice, your listeners, if you know, you pay close attention to the Mass, at the beginning of the Eucharist, when the priest says, you know, lift up your hearts, we lift them up to the Lord. Mm. Let us give thanks to the Lord our God. And we respond,
it is
right and just.
Yeah.
That's
what we say.
That's what we say.
Indeed.
So we give thanks to God, not just because I feel like giving thanks, but because justice
right.
requires that we give God thanks. And
that's interesting, because that's a very specific word choice.
That's right.
You know, I mean, very specific. It is right. It means one thing, but it is just.
Mm-hmm.
It means something entirely different.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, people for so many years, up until really modern times, understood the concept of worshiping mm-hmm. God, going to church, whether you're a Protestant or a Catholic,
right.
just the simple act of going to church and
yeah.
keeping the Sabbath day holy was, they may not have had it like in the forefront of their mind, consciously in their mind, but they understood that simply going to church on Sunday was the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the right thing to do. It's
right.
just what people did.
Right.
And they couldn't perhaps articulate it, but this is at the bottom reason, because people had this sense that justice required it. It was mm-hmm. the right thing to do.
Right.
Now, obviously, in order to attract people to Mass and to worship, really in this day and age especially, more is needed than just appealing to people's sense of justice.
Right.
That's why beauty is so important
sure.
in the liturgy.
Sure.
Because as a practical matter, many people go to Mass hoping to get something out of it, you know, a word of inspiration from the readings or the homily, you know, edification
sure.
through the music, you know, strength and support from the community, etc. So there's lots of reasons why people go to Mass, you know, for their own personal well-being and what they hope that they can get out of it and how they might grow to it. And there's nothing wrong with that, but the fundamental reason that we go to Mass is to worship God.
Yeah, and I think we miss that a lot. I mean, I go to Mass hoping for inspiration,
mm-hmm.
hoping for something that will spur me to be a better person, will strengthen whatever moral fiber I might have. All of that. I mean, it's hard to get beyond your own ego. It's hard to get beyond your own self. And, I mean, we need some ego or we wouldn't breathe.
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't deserve oxygen. Well,
right.
You're going to breathe.
Right.
You know, but still, I think sometimes we miss that as the prime reason we're going to Mass is to worship.
And that's also important because... Let's face it, there are a lot of times when I'm just not in the mood. You know, when you think about feeling love.
Yeah.
Feeling love for the community or feeling love towards God. Let's face it, you know, we're human beings. And there are times when I just don't feel particularly loving. But it doesn't matter how I feel. What matters is that I give God thanks mm-hmm. for all his blessings, and especially because of what he's done for me through Christ, who gave himself up to death, regardless of how I feel.
Right.
You know, I was trying to think of a sort of a real world analogy that maybe many of us could relate to. And I don't know, the one that came to my mind is like going to a restaurant, going out to eat or something. And, you know, the waiter or waitress, you know, brings you your food and is very pleasant and friendly. And you're not in a good mood necessarily, but your waitress is friendly and does what she's supposed to do. And social convention, but just instinct suggests that when we're finished with dinner, we say to the waitress, thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a common courtesy. We don't even think about it.
Right.
Well, we give thanks for that, not because I happen to be in a great mood and, you know, and all the rest of it, but because she deserves our thanks. And justice requires that this person who has brought us our food and waited on us and attended to our needs, she deserves our thanks.
Her just desserts, even if she didn't bring you dessert.
Exactly right. I set you up for that one, didn't I? Yeah, so justice.
Rehearsed this.
That's right. And even just a common, ordinary event like going out to dinner, you know, we understand that thanking a person, regardless of my mood or how I happen to feel about whatever's going on in my life, it's irrelevant. But just when somebody does something for us, it's just common courtesy to give thanks.
Very much so.
Because it's the right thing to do. Well, you can then extrapolate that or extend that on to this cosmic level where God, the creator of everything, has made everything that is the whole universe, which is so magnificently beautiful, and deep down inside, we want to express our gratitude to someone.
Yeah.
You know, I love going up to the mountains around here and up to the area around, you know, Portola and Gold Lake and Lakes Basin area,
beautiful
the Sierras,
country.
And it's just beautiful. Yeah, and.
Especially in the early fall.
Oh,
something about the early fall, which is just, you know, the chill and the leaves crunching and the...
Absolutely.
And some fall color. Because the fall color up there stands out among all the other of the evergreens.
Yeah.
Which don't change. And so the aspens and a few of those really stand out.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, I was just up there last weekend and rendezvoused with an old high school friend, a doctor... who's not a believer. And so we were sitting out on the little porch of his cabin and overlooking this beautiful lake, Sardine Lake. And it was just this quintessential, beautiful, mm-hmm. picturesque October, early fall day. It's just so beautiful. We were sitting out on the porch late afternoon, so that low shining sun is sort of casting a golden glow over everything. We're sitting out there drinking a glass of Zinfandel, and we got to talking religion.
Wow.
After a few sips of wine, we kind of loosened up a little bit.
Good for you.
Yeah. And, you know, and I've known this guy since junior high school, and and, you know, he said he doesn't believe in God, you know, but he says, you know, for him, you know, being out in an area like this is sure. for him akin to religion or God. And so we got to talking about this notion about how beautiful this area is. And what is it about beauty that appeals equally to him and to me?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So we both agree, we both can recognize beauty in nature in particular. And he was very appreciative of the beauty, as was I. But now the question becomes, what do you do with that appreciation?
Mm-hmm.
Who do you thank?
Who do you thank? Yeah.
He has no one to thank for that. Whereas I believe, you know, that God has created everything and that this beauty evident in the world around us is pointing to God and is itself a kind of a door to the divine. And so as we were chatting, I made the point that beauty, whether it's natural beauty, like up in the mountains, or the beauty of a beautifully composed symphony or choral piece of music, something that stirs us.
Right.
There's something about beauty that takes us out of ourselves. It has a transcendent power to it.
Right.
It not only has the power to take us out of ourselves, but beauty also points beyond itself. It doesn't just point at itself, it points beyond itself.
Mm-hmm.
So when we, you know, you listen to a beautiful composition, I don't know, like Mozart's Requiem, for example, you can appreciate the magnificence and the beauty of that composition in and of itself, but there's something about the beauty of that composition that also points beyond itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that transcendent power of beauty that points towards God. And of course, the difference between a believer and a non-believer is that a believer attributes that thing to which beauty points as God, the creator of heaven and earth. And also, and this is where the Christian revelation becomes so compelling, is that not only does the beauty of the natural world point beyond itself to the creator—
mm-hmm.
But as Christians, we also believe that the creator of the cosmos, the creator of all that is beautiful and good and true, has also taken on human form, has expressed himself to us mm-hmm. in a very personal way,
right.
in a way that we as individual humans can relate to in the person of Jesus Christ. And it's for all of these reasons, because God has created all this that surrounds us, all of this goodness and beauty, but also because, as the readings in this Sunday's readings indicate, that God has not just created all of this beauty, but he has also entered into the creation to heal it and to make it whole. That's the point of the story of the healing of the leper. In both stories, but in particular in the gospel, that God has come down to earth to make each one of us whole
mm-hmm.
so that we can properly worship God.
Very well said. You know, when I have the, what you're calling the Sardine Lake experience, I have not been to Sardine Lake, but I know about Sardine Lake. Echo Lake for me, or Fallen Leaf, Priest Lake up in Idaho. The most lakes are pretty cool. They're all flat, but they're all pretty cool.
I hope they're flat. Water has a tendency to do that.
To flatten out, you know. What it tells me, or walking in the redwoods, the magnificent redwoods, or the sequoias, Yosemite, all those places, the Zion, it tells me the best is yet to come.
Mm, yeah.
The person who made all this, a person's probably not the right word, but the person who made all this has even bigger plans.
Yeah. The other thing that occurred to me as we were overlooking Sardine Lake and just enjoying the beautiful fall afternoon and everything around us is that, and I told him this, I said, you know, this has been a really, really great day and beautiful afternoon, but I got to get going.
Yeah.
I had to come back to Sacramento. And I said to him, you know, all good things must come to an end. And you're sitting there on the porch of this cabin overlooking the lake. And it's just so beautiful. And you don't want to leave.
Right.
You don't want this moment to end. And I got to thinking that hunger or that desire for this moment to just last forever is also one of those instincts that we have for heaven, for eternity, where this beauty of which we now have a foretaste in the things that God has made, that there will come a time where it will not end. It will be forever. And it was very consoling to imagine that. But in this world, even the best experiences, whether it's out in nature or, you know, socializing with friends or going to a ball game or traveling, eventually all of those things come to an end. A great meal. Eventually it comes to an end. So everything in this world eventually comes to an end. And yet, in our gut, in our instinct, we have this sense that it shouldn't end.
Right, right.
Well, C.S. Lewis made the wonderful point, speaking in another vein, but a related vein, and that is that for every human desire that we have, there's a corresponding something that satisfies that desire. Right. We get hungry, there's food. We get cold, there's fire. You know, so we have desires for things in this world, desires that can be satisfied by something. So we have this desire for this everlasting, eternal condition of beauty and goodness and tranquility and peace. So, according to Lewis's logic, there should be something that satisfies that. And he makes the point that we discover that there's nothing in this world that satisfies that desire.
Mm-hmm.
And so the conclusion has to be that there's something outside this world or beyond this world that alone can satisfy that desire, and that is what we call God.
Yeah, I've had that, can I freeze it, moment many times. I remember with our first child, 5 months old, and my wife and I, and we're up in Washington State, and we're standing on the beach, Pacific Ocean out there, and I'm explaining to this five-month-old all about the ocean and pointing and just like speaking normal English to her, like she could understand everything. Obviously, they're picking something up because at some point they do start talking. So something's registering, and people say, well, you don't talk to them because they can't understand anyway. Yeah, they do. And I remember saying to my wife, I just want to freeze this moment. Why can't this moment just last forever? And she's had frequent moments like that too with the kids. And then one day, there they are posing in the front yard by our favorite tree on the first day of kindergarten. and you go, oh, I want to freeze this moment. And then this year, just about 2 weeks ago, there she goes off first day of college. And we're going to freeze that moment. And I go, but if we had froze it when she was 5 months old, we'd have never got this moment, you know? And it's a real lesson to you that God's always got something around the corner.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a wonderful thing that, you know, being a human being, it's quite the adventure.
It is.
And, you know, these readings for this Sunday, again, you know, coming back to our topic for today, that is the act of worship, is what happens at Mass is it's taking all of those moments, the ones you were describing about your daughter and wanting to freeze those individual moments, or me up at the mountains with my old high school friend and wanting to freeze those moments. It's taking all of those moments and, you know, sort of putting them together in all one beautiful package and offering them to God.
Yeah.
And being able to say, you know, thank you, Lord. You know, thank you, God, for all of this, for all of those moments. And all of those moments of love and beauty that point to you. And at Mass, we have a moment, another moment, when we can actually be in intimate communion with the source of all of those moments of our lives, those beautiful moments of our lives. But we're with the author of all of those moments. And for a moment, he gives us himself, and we are joined to him in communion. And for a moment, we have a foretaste of eternity. And so how else can we respond except by saying thank you and falling on our knees and worshiping and adoring the Lord?
I've had people say to me, and I'm sure people, maybe even your friends, say, well, it's good that works for you. You know, and if you need that, that's a good thing. Go for it. And you go, well, it doesn't matter if I believe in God or not. I mean, it matters, but God exists even if I don't believe in God.
Right.
You know, it's not a need. Maybe it's a need, but my need's irrelevant to the existence of God. God exists, period.
Well,
even if not one person on earth believes in God, God exists.
Well, there...
It's a fact.
Yeah, there's a need insofar as we all have a need. I don't care whether you're a believer or a non-believer, but there is a need that we have to say thank you.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely.
For example, the holiday that's coming up in about a month,
yep.
Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
You know, once upon a time, that was established by Lincoln as an opportunity for the nation to give thanks. And in those proclamations that Lincoln gave, it was very clear that the thanks was directed to God.
Absolutely.
Well, we live in a very secular nation now, right. Especially in this part of the world. And people still celebrate Thanksgiving.
That's right.
But they don't give thanks to God necessarily, but they still have a need to give thanks.
Yeah.
You know, they give thanks to the universe or give thanks to Mother Earth or Gaia or whoever.
The West Wind.
The West Wind.
I actually heard that one time. They praised the West Wind.
Ah, I see. West Wind.
Even though we don't get a West Wind here.
Not usually. Yeah. So this idea of worship is so important. And it's not only is it a... related to this idea of justice, you know, giving something, that's what worship, giving something its due, it's worship. Here's what the Catechism said in relation to this. This is from paragraph number 2095, for those of you who are taking notes. It says, the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity inform and give life to the moral virtues. Thus, charity... love, leads us to render to God what we as creatures owe him in all justice. The virtue of religion disposes us to have this attitude. And what's interesting about that particular paragraph is that if you relate it to paragraph 1807, which speaks about justice particularly, it says, justice is the moral virtue that consists in the constant and firm will to give their due to God and neighbor. Justice towards God is called the virtue of religion. So a lot of times people will say, well, I'm a good person.
Yeah.
Well, we believe, at any rate, that part of being, quote unquote, a good person, a virtuous person, is giving thanks to God, going to church. So when people say, well, I can be a good person without going to church. No, you can't. According to the teachings of the church, I would not say that to my neighbor. But in reality, part of being a virtuous person, a good person, is giving thanks to God.
Right.
And that's, in fact, the first duty of a virtuous person because of the great commandment, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, and all thy strength. This is the first and great commandment. The second is like it, love thy neighbor as thyself.
And it's interesting the order of those, you know, because, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, that's something you expect Jesus to say. And all the other commandments flow from that, basically, and that's something you'd expect Jesus to say. But the first, the greatest, is not as obvious, and yet Jesus said it, so it is obvious.
And in fact, it's the first.
It's the first,
and he's exactly. First and greatest. And it's only because of our love for God that our love for neighbor can be authentic and exactly. true and good.
Exactly. So is your friend from Sardine Lake, did he sign up for RCIA?
No, not yet. Yeah, so this section in the Catechism is really worth reading, especially for this, in light of the readings for this coming Sunday. Yeah. So just to repeat, this is paragraph 2095 and following. It's in part 3 of the Catechism, which has to do with the moral life. And the next paragraph, 2096, speaks about adoration. Adoration is a form of worship, another word for worship. We're all familiar. Most of our parishes have like a holy hour and adoration of the Blessed Sacrament.
Right.
So we're familiar with the word in that light, in light of Eucharistic adoration. But adoration is just another word for worship. And it says here, adoration is the first act of the virtue of religion. To adore God is to acknowledge him as God, as the creator and savior, Lord and master of everything that exists, as infinite and merciful love. And then it concludes with this quote from Luke 4, where Jesus says to the devil, you know, in the temptations, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. And so this act of worship and adoration, which is due to God and God alone, is our primary duty as human beings, but especially as Catholics. Why do we go to Mass? To worship God, to give him thanks for all the good he has done for us.
So adore, gift, is adore, is that the same root?
I did not do a search on the word adoration, but that would be another interesting etymological research.
Yeah.
We'll do that next week, the etymology of adoration.
I want to see if the D-O-R is the, if that's the gift, if there's a gift word in there, but I don't know.
Well, I'm just speculating here, but it looks like it comes from two Latin words, ad, with the prefix, the first two letters of adoration, ad, means towards. Mm-hmm. And oratio is to pray or praise. Mm-hmm. So adoration, I'm just guessing, I'd have to do my homework on this, but adoration means to give praise to, okay, or offer worship to, in this case, God. And then the next paragraph, just to conclude this section, says to adore God is to acknowledge in respect and absolute submission the nothingness of the creature who would not exist but for God. To adore God is to praise and exalt him and to humble oneself, as Mary did in the Magnificat. Notice what the leper does in the gospel for this week. When he returns to Jesus, it says he falls at Jesus' feet. So that gesture of falling at the feet of Jesus, an act of submission, mm-hmm, an act of humility, which is also an act of worship, which is why at Mass we kneel. We kneel during the Eucharist, and we kneel during the Eucharistic prayer, and then we also kneel at the Lamb of God, when the Lamb of God is priest elevates the host, and we then fall on our knees and say, Lord, I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof, but only say the word and my soul shall be healed. It's also one of the reasons it's a little bit controversial nowadays, but every now and then I get people asking me about kneeling for Holy Communion, because that's the way you used to do it,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
Used to be altar rails.
We'd go up to the rail and we'd all
line up.
Kind of a semicircle around, yep, this altar rail.
And that was one of the big changes that happened after Vatican II, although I should note, was never even mentioned by Vatican II. That was a development that came later. And the norm of standing for communion is a norm that's peculiar to the United States. It's not a universal norm. It's a norm in the United States. People tell me, you know, they'll travel overseas, they'll go to Italy or some other Eastern European country, and they say, yeah, people knelt for communion.
In these other countries, are they still at a communion rail, or are they coming up and individually kneeling down before receiving the host?
Well, since most of these churches are very ancient churches, mm-hmm, most of them are kneeling at altar rails.
Still,
in these very old churches. So, but the reason
I liked that tradition.
A lot of people do, and people ask me about it, and what it tells me though is that there. Again, it goes back to this idea that we as human beings have this instinctive need to give thanks, to adore, to worship God. And there are few physical gestures that express gratitude and worship, especially worship, more than kneeling.
Right.
And so people, you know, have... Many people would like to be able to kneel for communion, and because they it expresses an interior need that they have.
Sure.
Yeah.
And how did it wasn't mentioned in Vatican II?
No, not at all.
So it was an act of the USCCB, perhaps? Maybe there's nothing wrong with it. It's just I'm expressing I just like that. Others, it's kind of like,
How did it happen? I don't know. I don't know. But it did happen with the reform of the liturgy, right, after 1970. Mm-hmm. But exactly how it all came about and what the rationale was for it, I don't know. It could be perhaps related to the Eastern Church, because in the Eastern Orthodox Church, it's customary to receive Eucharist standing. Uh-huh. Of course, in the Eastern Orthodox Church, at least in very traditional churches, well, in all ancient churches, whether it was West or East, there were no such things as pews.
Right.
Everybody
right.
just stood for the whole thing.
Sure.
So the posture of standing for worship and therefore receiving communion was just common, and is still common in Eastern Orthodox churches. So I think it could have been perhaps because so much of the reforms following Vatican II were an attempt to recover more ancient practices of worship rather than more quote-unquote recent or modern medieval practices. We think of medieval as being, well, medieval. Yeah. But in the context of whole church history, medieval practices are relatively modern.
That's right.
Yeah. Sort of like the example I use are the chasubles. So, you know, the chasubles that most priests wear now, the typical chasuble you'll see on Sunday Mass, is actually the more ancient style, the Roman style, goes back to ancient Rome. Whereas the style of the chasuble that's worn in the extraordinary form Mass, typically, or the so-called Latin Rite Mass, which is called the fiddleback chasuble, that actually developed in more the Middle Ages. So relative to ancient Rome, it's a modern innovation. Yeah. It's kind of funny to think about, but at any rate, the point is that just as the common chasuble that we see now is actually reaching back to a further time in the really the patristic area, the ancient church, so also this posture of standing to receive communion, I think, harkens back to that original period before pews or kneelers were even invented.
So what do we know about the Last Supper? How
they celebrated
it? How the bread was distributed? Were people sitting, standing, kneeling? Was it broken into pieces
out?
Was it passed around and everybody tore a piece off, or was it individual? I mean, did they take it on the tongue? Did they take it in their hands? Did all these things that people debate today about what's right and what's wrong, or I like it this way, you like it that way? People get into pretty good debates about some of that stuff.
Well,
what do we know about the Last Supper?
Well, I can tell you a little bit, and part of it, this comes from a book called Turning Towards the Lord by Andrew Lang, I think is the way his last name is pronounced, and I think it's spelled L-U-E-N-G or something like that, but I think it's pronounced Lang. I'm not sure of the author's name, but the title of the book is called Turning Towards the Lord. Anyway, he has a chapter in there talking about, how did the disciples celebrate that first Passover.
Oh, interesting. I got to read it.
And evidently, the way that because we think of, you know, Jesus sat at table. So we think of like our dining room table
right,
at home.
Exactly.
And they're all sitting around the table, right, in kind of a circle.
Right.
Well, he says that's not the way tables were designed in the ancient world, especially for important occasions like this. It said the tables in those days were shaped more kind of like a horseshoe, kind of a U-shape. And all of the people partaking of the meal all sat on the same side of the table.
On the same side of the table, yeah.
And that was so then the servants could then serve from the other side,
the
inside of the horseshoe, so to speak. And so
a lot easier on the servants.
A lot easier on the servants, yeah. And so the idea was that what Jesus and his disciples probably sat at was this horseshoe-shaped table. And they, in Jewish custom for the Passover, it would be a very low table where they would recline. So that was that posture of reclining to enjoy your supper was also the sign of a free person. So the table would have been a horseshoe shape or a semicircle where all the disciples sat on the same side of the table. Servants served from the inside of that horseshoe, and that the disciples would have been reclining to enjoy their... You notice in John's Gospel, for example, where it talks about the disciple John, it says, and the beloved disciples was reclining against Jesus's breast. So that whole posture of reclining at the table, but that's an indication of how they celebrated that Passover. Now, as far as the actual distribution of the bread, the matzah, the unleavened bread, whether Jesus actually broke it apart himself and then gave individuals or just broke it and then handed them to pieces and they communicate, I don't know. And this book doesn't speak about that. I guess you would have to do a little bit further study on how Passover was celebrated.
And of course, you know, it's easy too to say, well, the tradition at the time was this, but that doesn't mean that Jesus necessarily would have followed the tradition at the time because he was a pretty untraditional guy.
Yeah, well, he takes something that was traditional, the Passover, and adds new elements to it. So, yeah, there's actually a couple of books, The Jewish Roots of the Eucharist, by Brant Petrie. He's written a couple books on this subject, and he has some YouTube videos, too. You can just Google Andrew Petrie, P-I-T-R-E, and he talks about the Jewish roots of the Eucharist, and he touches upon a number of these things. He's done quite a lot of research on how Passover was celebrated at the time of Jesus, just amongst common Jews, and then how Jesus would have modified it and transformed it into what we now call the Eucharist. The Eucharist is what's celebrated now. This is what's also interesting historically. Is when you go to Mass and you celebrate the Eucharist, we're not celebrating like a reenactment of the Last Supper. It evolves. It has evolved from that. The Last Supper is the basis of the Eucharist, but the Eucharist is not like a re-dramatization of the Last Supper. In fact, what the Eucharist is a fusion, so to speak, of the Last Supper and Calvary. So that's why it looks the way it does, because it has elements of both, a supper, Passover supper, but also it has elements of sacrifice and cross. We call the altar the cross of the Lord, and the catechism calls it that. So the Eucharist has elements of both in it. So the Eucharist as we know it today is, like I said, a fusion of the Last Supper and the sacrifice of Christ on the cross. You know, because a lot of times people think that the Eucharist is simply a reenactment of the Last Supper and that the altar is simply the table.
Right.
Well, yes and no. It's more than that. It's not just a reenactment of the Last Supper. It has elements of that. But even Jesus's own celebration of the Last Supper, that Passover, has sacrificial elements of it. In fact, it's important to remember that Passover, even the Jewish Passover itself, is a sacrificial meal. The protagonist in the Passover meal is the lamb who is sacrificed. And that sacrificed lamb is what gave the ancient Jews their freedom from Egypt. So even if we were to simply say that the Mass is a reenactment of the Last Supper, the Passover Supper, it's still, even if we just look at it that way, it's still a sacrificial meal. So sacrifice is still a pivotal idea in the Eucharist.
James, I will be listening closely to the readings this Sunday. Thanks so much. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916 916-
972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of America, Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
I was sure by now, God, you would have reached down and wiped our tears away, stepped in and saved the day. But once again, I say amen, and it's still raining. But as the thunder rolls, I barely hear you whisper through the rain, I'm with you. And as your mercy falls, I'll raise my hands and praise the God who gives and takes away. Torn.
I'ma praise you in the storm. I remember when I stumbled in the wind. You heard my cry to you and raised me up again. But my strength is almost gone. How can I carry on if I can't find